Hello and welcome to Sparks on Radio Fax, 6205 and 12255 every Monday and Tuesday. It's our weekly programme of technical news and features. And this week, cross-modulation in the sky, digital sound in the cinema, a tribute to the late Bob Widlar, designer of the first IC op-amp, a look at loudspeaker cables, sick building syndrome, multiplex wiring in the modern car, digital audio broadcasting, and of course your letters, so stay tuned to Sparks.
Hands on deck. Here's something on the subject of loudspeaker cables. A proper authoritative paper from the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. Effects of Cable, Loudspeaker and Amplifier Interactions by Fred E. Davis, an engineering consultant from Hamden, Connecticut in the USA. A variety of speciality loudspeaker cables can be found advertised in almost any audio magazine from the last 10 years. All promise the same result, better sound, yet they span the gamut of electrical characteristics, geometries, and materials. How loudspeaker cables work is often based more on presumption and speculation than on fact. Few articles are published exploring the behavior of these mandatory components in journals and popular magazines. Debates continue, and white papers available for manufacturers, but otherwise unpublished, are frequently more marketing than science. Using a simplistic view of how loudspeakers and cables work, conventional wisdom would suggest that since loudspeakers exhibit a low impedance, nominally 4 to 8 ohms, then the cable should have even lower resistance. As a result, monster cables were introduced. Then a more complex view of cables emerged, suggesting that loudspeaker cables would perform better with less capacitance or more inductance, or the skin effect, phase shift, and dispersion were veiling high frequencies, or they behaved like transmission lines. These factors are the essence of high-end cables. In short, loudspeaker cables are not transmission lines. Audio frequency wavelengths are much too long compared to the length of the cables. Phase shift and dispersion effects are too small to be audible, typically less than 0.3 degrees per meter at 20 kHz. And the skin effect has only a small effect on heavy conductors. The skin depth in copper at 20 kHz is 0.5 millimeters. It is no secret that loudspeakers offer a complex load to the amplifier. While an isolated loudspeaker is predominantly inductive, the complex impedance of most loudspeaker systems with multiple drivers and passive crossover networks exhibits both negative and positive phase angles at given frequencies, indicating capacitive reactance as well as inductive reactance. With given complex waveforms, commercial loudspeakers require up to 6.6 times more current than an 8-ohm resistor for the same waveform, suggesting a dynamic impedance as low as 1.2 ohms. The ideal loudspeaker cable should transfer all audio frequencies into any loudspeaker load with a flat voltage response. Real cables will always show some loss due to resistance, but better cables will both minimize this loss and still transfer all frequencies unscathed. The acoustical result will depend on many factors, but the electrical interaction of loudspeaker, amplifier, and cable forms an essential foundation. This engineering report examines the mechanisms for this interaction and shows how it can affect the response of the system. The samples of cables gathered for this test represents a variety of commonly and uncommonly available wire. Most of the samples were 3.1 meters or 10 feet in length. Some are very expensive, over $619 per meter. Others cheap, $1.9 per meter. And some are not loudspeaker cables at all. This is not an exhaustive examination of every loudspeaker cable available. The following is a brief description of each type. Well, what then follows is a list of 12 different cables selected for examination in this report. And it includes some non-loudspeaker cables, such as auto jumper cables, literally from the garage, two thick parallel 9.5 millimeter diameter conductors of approximately 7 American wire gauge. And another interesting cable which comes out extremely well in the report is the SpectraStrip ribbon cable, made of 32 twisted pairs of 26 gauge wire arranged in a flat ribbon, intended for high-speed differential data transmission, equivalent to about 8 American wire gauge. Apart from that, there are high-end cables from Krell, Levinson, AudioQuest, Kimber, and an ordinary Belden twin flex figure of eight lamp wire for mains use. The paper then goes through graphical presentation of various examples of cable parameters, DC resistance, the cable impedance versus frequency, which shows quite a difference in frequency response delivered to a test load at 20 kHz, the worst being 0.5 dB down, the best being 0.02 dB down at 20 kHz. It then goes into test loudspeaker and amplifier characteristics and cable response with loudspeaker loads, and the loudspeaker cable model, amplifier effects, where it's shown that certain cables can actually produce a rise in response delivered to the loudspeaker due to the damping factor of the amplifier and the characteristics of the cable. So to the conclusions. If loudspeakers were only simple resistance, then large, low-resistance cables would not be a bad idea. However, loudspeaker systems exhibit a frequency-dependent complex impedance that can interact with the reactive components of amplifier and cable. The best response was obtained with low-inductance cables, and an amplifier with low-inductance output and a high frequency-independent damping factor. These tests have shown that the best way to achieve adequately low resistance and inductance in a cable is by using many independently insulated wires per conductor rather than one large wire. Efforts to reduce the skin effect, such as Litz wire construction, will help, but due more to the reduction of inductance than the reduction of the skin effect. Inductive reactance is more significant in large cables than the skin effect. If an amplifier does not disagree, larger capacitance in a cable is not significant, since this component is comparatively small and reduces amplifier and cable inductive reactance effects. The best performance was measured with the multi-conductor cables Spectra Strip, Kimber and AudioQuest Litz. Smaller multi-conductor cables, such as the Kimber 8LPC, Kimber 4PR and Spectra Strip smaller version, also performed well. Of the two wire cables, 12 American wire gauge provided the best performance with reactive loads, while both smaller and larger gauges showed greater high frequency drop and interaction with capacitive reactance in a load. 12 AWG seems more than adequate even for demanding systems, high power levels and reasonable lengths. The effects of 3.1 meter cable lengths are subtle, so many situations may not warrant the use of special cables. Low inductance cables will provide the best performance when driving reactive loads, especially with amplifiers having low damping factor, and when flat response is critical, when long cable lengths are required, or when perfection is sought. Though not as linear as flat cables, 12 AWG wire works well and exceeds the high frequency performance of other two conductor cables tested, including many from hi-fi shops. By the way, keep the auto jumper cables in the garage. So to summarize, the best sort of loudspeaker cable is lots of twisted pairs all connected up in parallel, the example tested being a 32 pair ribbon data cable. That authoritative paper from Fred Davis in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society.
1, 2, 3, Hot pants! Hey, hot pants! Hot pants! Smoking the hot pants! That bar is at, that bar is at. Take your minds up on, it look much better time. My feet keep going, girl, blowing my mind. Thinking of losing that funky feeling, don't, cause you got to use what you got to get just what you want, hey. Hot pants make you sure to sell. Good God, you won't like. You got the only love left. Hey, so brother. the woman got you. What you got? Just what you want. Hey! Hey! Hot pants! Now look, hot pants won't make you dance, but as slick as you are, you make the pants. The hot pants on, she can do the funky Broadway all night long. The girl on there with the hot pants on, filthy Mac danced all night long. Get down, the one over there with the bandy dress, I ain't got time. Still dig that mess. Get down. But I like hot pants. Hey, I like hot pants.
Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie.
Jackie. Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
Close enough to really care as Greg should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station. Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
Here's a letter from Ulf Palmenfelt in Umeå in Sweden. He writes, I had the great pleasure of listening to your transmission on 6205 kHz. My receiver is a Kenwood R2000 and I used a 180 metre long wire antenna. Phew, I wish I had a garden that long. I'm 44 years old, work as a teacher and writer in Swedish ethnology. I'm married and have two sons and one daughter. Thanks for your letter, Ulf. So if you'd like to write to Radio Fax, which I'm sure you would, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And if you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. Every Monday and Tuesday you can hear Sparks this week. It's presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Moving on to something from Electronic Product Design. Has multiplex wiring finally arrived? For 15 years or so, it has been expected that fully multiplexed wiring systems would appear, usually within the next 5 years. However, 1991 looks like the year that multiplexed wiring will become practical, with the arrival of several new semiconductor products from the major silicon suppliers. As the number and diversity of electronic modules has increased in the modern car, interconnections required to make these modules function have multiplied in number. Gearboxes are now connected to dashboards, engine management systems, ABS controllers, whilst even car radios may be connected to the dashboard, a separate CD player, and car security system. Integration of functions is obvious in many of the cars of today, where, for example, activating the central locking system will result in the electric windows and sunroof closing and the alarm being automatically armed. With the increase in the specifications of higher cost models, the amount of wiring in the car has increased to such an extent that it is now often difficult to find suitably sized channels through which the wiring loom can be routed. The reliability of the car electronic and electrical system is proportional to the number of connections, so it follows that the strain placed on providing the correct connector at the correct cost increases. Ironically, it's concern over the mechanical nature of the connector which has led to the search for alternative solutions to the car wiring problem, one of which may lead to an increase in the electronic content. Multiplexed wiring is one such alternative, where instead of one electronic signal having its own circuit from source to destination, it has access to a single bus, which is routed throughout the vehicle, carrying all of the signals digitally on a time multiplexed basis. Advantages of this approach are manifold. For example, the wiring loom virtually disappears, to be replaced by a typically two-wire bus, the number of connectors decreasing proportionally. Access to a common bus reduces the need for multiple sensors in the car, as data can be shared between all modules on the bus, and the concept of a single diagnostic bus becomes a reality. The theory is relatively simple, but in practice there are many restrictions on the nature of the bus. For example, many of the modules will require high-speed communications, thus necessitating a medium capable of transmission speeds far in excess of the less complex modules. Similarly, as all of the electronic modules have to be able to talk digitally to this bus, we have to ensure that all the components speak the same language. Today there are several standards in use in the European automotive industry for general purpose, medium to high speed data transfer between modules, driven by a mixture of auto manufacturers and other bodies. All the standards have their own advantages and disadvantages. Fortunately, one or two of the leading semiconductor manufacturers are preparing to break this loop, and microcontroller solutions to multiplexed wiring applications are beginning to appear. For example, during 1991, Motorola will be releasing 4 devices through its microcontroller division aimed at the needs of multiplexed wiring systems. So, to the question of, what next? Will there be a single global standard for multiplexing systems in the automotive electronics sector? The answer has to be no, at least in the short term, since in addition to the 4 standards mentioned, there are several proprietary protocols in development in Europe, the United States and of course Japan. There is also the burning question of cost, where the new multiplex-compatible module must cost at a maximum the sum of the cost of the old module plus the wires and connectors saved. suggesting that partial multiplex systems will be a logical first step. So while there is confusion about the success of the various approaches, the submodule manufacturers cannot afford the silicon overhead to make their modules compatible with all protocols, having to wait instead for the situation to develop further. The next question is then, when will we see the single bus, fully multiplexed car in production? The answer to this may be never, since studies increasingly show that two or more buses may be required for different applications. For example, Motorola has looked very closely at the requirements for a low-end bus, where the microcontroller module control is not required, and has developed its MI bus for applications such as stepper motor control. There will also be the requirement for mid-range buses and high-end, thereby opening up opportunities to the silicon supplier who can manufacture gateway interfaces between the various bus speeds and protocols. It is almost certain that the first applications for multiplexed wiring will be in the body electronics area. The mid-1990s will see for certain fully multiplexed, though not necessarily on a single bus, cars, led in part by the availability now of the first integrated devices. The challenge, however, for this half of the decade is to ensure that the silicon products for the next generation of cars are set in design now. For this to happen, we have to build on the products of today, with the car manufacturer's help, to ensure that we have the correct, cost-effective solutions at the right time. Waiting for a single standard to emerge could involve a long wait and a loss of a major market opportunity. That was Bill Matthews writing in Electronic Product Design.
Out of everything.
Policymakers should accept that the multi-channel revolution has failed to materialise, argues Stephen Barnett in The Independent. Why satellite television is pie in the sky. The next 2 or 3 years are critical for television. Whoever wins the next election will be defining the scope and purpose of the BBC after its charter expires in 1996. At the same time, the Commercial Television Regulatory Body, the Independent Television Commission, will have its judgment and resolve tested by those commercial operators it seeks to control. Government ministers, civil servants, programme makers and regulators will be making a series of strategic decisions that ultimately will determine what appears on our screens. There is a growing danger that these decisions will be founded on a fundamental misconception about the impact of new channels on British viewing habits. It is received wisdom that we are witnessing a revolution in broadcasting and that four-channel television will soon be as antiquated as Bakelite telephones or black-and-white television images. Ostensibly, the evidence is irrefutable. As many as 20 additional channels are available if your home is passed by underground fibre optic cable, to which you can connect for as little as £10 a month. And at least 9 English language channels are available via satellite in return for a £250 receiving dish. It is perhaps understandable, then, that there should be much excited talk about the transformation of British television, the irrelevance of regulation, and the anachronism of a compulsory licence fee with so many channels on offer. But this is a mistaken analysis that fails to understand the relatively minor role of television in people's lives. A more dispassionate look at the facts suggests a different story. That the multi-channel revolution is a fiction manufactured through a combination of unsupported conviction and self-serving propaganda to convince city lending institutions. The truth is more prosaic. Our four-channel system has emerged virtually unscathed from the competitive inroads of new technology. The multi-channel revolution is a myth. The evidence starts with cable. By the end of 1985, cable systems were operating in 8 different areas. Those operators have had 5 years to promote and sell the advantages of multi-channel television to the 50,000 or so homes in their area. Even the most successful in Swindon have succeeded in persuading only 1 in 4 households to pay the monthly connection fee. The less successful, such as Glasgow and Coventry, have struggled to persuade 1 in 10. Second, there is satellite. Rupert Murdoch launched Sky's four-channel system in a blaze of publicity on the 5th of May 1989. British Satellite Broadcasting launched another satellite service 14 months later. After 7 months of faltering operation, it collapsed, having sold a paltry 117,000 dishes. Before its merger with BSB, Mr. Murdoch had sunk £600 million into Sky. The combined operation has soaked up another £500 million. Even with the advantage of free publicity in News International newspapers, sales of satellite dishes have crawled to their current level of 1.5 million. They are still selling, but monthly figures are down 25% on equivalent months of last year. Most tellingly, however, there is the evidence of those who have experienced the variety of choices on offer. In those homes where dishes have been installed or a monthly subscription to cable is paid, recent figures show that 60% of viewing is still devoted to the 4 traditional channels. There is also evidence from last year's experiment in the village of Waddington, where 32 households were given access to 29 cable and satellite channels for a 5-week period. While a few enjoyed the variety, most were unimpressed. One woman gave a frank, if blunt, reaction. What a waste of money. Yet still there are those who insist that these myriad opportunities will soon be grasped by whole swathes of the population. It is a strange triumph of hope over experience. With its roots in the unbridled optimism of the 80s, everyone wanted to believe the new television technologies would challenge the entrenched duopoly and become a lasting monument to private enterprise and innovation. Confidence was fueled by frequent stories from across the Atlantic. Hadn't cable thrived in America, provided literally dozens of specialist channels to supplement the networks? And weren't more than half of American households prepared to pay for cable television, some willing to hand out an extra $15 or $20 a month for premium movie or sports channels? But the model was never appropriate. Cable had two driving forces in the US, neither applicable to the UK. Poor reception over the air encouraged viewers to switch to the far better pictures that cable could deliver, and the narrow range of programmes offered by network broadcasters presented gaps in specialist areas such as news, sport, arts, and children's programmes that were open to exploitation by cable operators. Britain's high technical standards for over-the-air transmission and the proven diversity of programming from its four terrestrial channels makes any comparison futile. Mistaken presumptions about the attraction of new channels would be unremarkable, were it not for their impact on policymakers. Within the last few weeks, two influential policy think tanks have published papers on the future of broadcasting. The right-wing Centre for Policy Studies, whose deliberations have had a material influence on government policy, argues that the broadcasting landscape will be transformed by cable and satellite, and that the BBC's audience share will plunge. On that basis, it condemns the licence fee as indefensible and calls for, in effect, the dismemberment of the BBC, which would then be forced to compete with others for a share of licence fee revenue. The Left of Centre Institute for Public Policy Research, which can be expected to exert a major influence on a future Labour government, goes further in denouncing the licence fee. With an estimated 8 million satellite dishes on British walls by the mid-90s, its life has surely come to an end, it says. This is the Institute's justification for funding the BBC directly from the Treasury, where it would compete with schools, hospitals, road improvements and other areas of public expenditure with somewhat higher priority. As the publicly funded Australian Broadcasting Corporation's experience has shown, direct funding carries a much greater risk of real cuts in income as well as political interference. How much greater the sin if the rationale for this absurd policy is itself bogus? There will not be 8 million satellite dishes on British walls by the mid-90s, nor anything approaching that number. The underlying truth is that we are used to receiving free television, and that it is simply not important enough to induce us to spend money on buying more of it. According to Henley Centre research, 30% of the population say they would watch less television if they had more money. Once the recession is over and incomes start to rise again, there is every reason to believe that the trend of the last 5 years away from television will continue. With both disposable time and income being squeezed, most people have neither the time nor the inclination to make use of more channels. No one can deny the value of additional viewing choices. There are still many films, sport events, important programmes and pop videos that cannot get an airing on terrestrial television. All these are desirable complements to existing channels, but they are peripheral to the main viewing diet. There is a rosier future for new communications initiatives that are not solely television-led. Cable subscriptions will see a gradual but steady rise, not for its multiple television channels, but for the cheaper and more personalised telephone service, the interactive shopping and mailing facilities, and the genuinely local television that cable operators will be able to provide. Cable offers exciting opportunities because it has added value, and its use will not be restricted to the passive and often indiscriminate reception of television images. Even that will be a process of evolution as the systems are built and the benefits explained. Meanwhile, it is time we stopped talking about the television revolution, still less making policy on the basis of fallacious predictions. The writer of that, Stephen Barnett, is director of the Henley Centre's Media Group and visiting lecturer at Goldsmiths College.
This is called Anthem!
We'll be right back.
Live Rush on Radio Fax. As well as saying hello to you, I'll happily play your requests as well, so please write in a letter. Hello, my name is Wayne Ashcroft. I am 14 years old and have decided to enter your competition. More on that in a week or so, because we've had having a few entries for that. Your Sparks and Rock Music programmes are great, but I'm not fond of your Solid Gold Sunday programmes, he continues. So on Sunday, I switch on my small homemade transmitter, plug my Walkman in it and put out a continuous non-stop rock music programme for 2 hours and repeat the programme until close down at 7pm. I broadcast from 7am till 7pm on the Sunday. The frequency I use is 105.1 FM. I only have a few listeners as my transmitter is not very powerful. It runs off 2 9-volt batteries, but I enjoy it. I began broadcasting on New Year's Day 1991 on 212 meters 1413 kilohertz, but changed 3 weeks later to 1600 kilohertz, and 2 months after that to 101.5 FM. At the moment I'm working on possible 6290 broadcasts, so keep your ears open. If I win the competition, it'll be great. Well, I'll be in touch with you about that, Wayne. Thanks. He lives in Walsall in the West Midlands. Also, he's contributed a few pirates to the FM feature. You yourself can write in if you have heard any local pirates, or of course shortwave pirates as well. I'll give you the address in a bit. He lists Freedom 102 playing pop music, 88 Radio Sangam playing Asian music, 105.6 Radio Milan playing Asian music again, and 103.9 PCRL, which is one I've heard from Loughborough, playing reggae music. They're also in Birmingham. And his station is called Radio Seagull, and that can be heard on 105.1 FM. Well, I'll give you my own list of the London pirates that you can hear at the moment. 89.9 Chic FM play dance, 92 Power Jam is soul and dance, 98.5 In League, I think the name is, playing dance and reggae, 100.5 Green Apple Radio playing soul and dance, 101 Station FM playing reggae and things, very weak 101.9 Soca Radio, and also quite weak where I am, 94.3 Innocence. You're listening to Sparks. The address: Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. And if you'd like a reply, don't forget to send your 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline, from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D, test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, PO Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, PO Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.
Here's a bit from Electronic Design. It's a regular article written by Bob Pease, who's a senior scientist at National Semiconductor. And this week, what's all this Widlar stuff anyhow? When we got the word that Bob Widlar had passed away on February the 27th, at the young age of 53, we all began to bring out stories of things Widlar had done. There are lots of good Widlar stories, and many of them have been printed recently. I will just try to tell the ones that nobody else has told. Just before I continue, Widlar was the designer of the first IC op-amp, the 709, amongst many other things. First of all, Widlar did not bring in a goat to chew down the unmowed lawns at National when the pay to the gardeners was cut back. That would be absurd. Widlar did not do that. What he brought in was a sheep. I can prove it, because Fran Hoffart showed me a picture of the sheep. Widlar brought in the sheep in the back seat of his Mercedes-Benz convertible. That would be nice to document with a photo, but Fran didn't get a photo of the sheep's arrival. However, Bob Dobkin told me that he drove up with Widlar and the sheep after Widlar had bought the sheep in Morgan Hill for $60. Dobkin said that after the sheep was tied to a tree in front of National's headquarters, the news photographers took 20 minutes to show up. At the end of the day, Widlar went over to a bar and took the sheep with him. He left the sheep with the bartender. That leads to another story, about the time Bob made the gardeners unhappy. Nobody remembers exactly what he did to make them so unhappy, but it must have been pretty bad. One person said maybe it was the time Widlar could not find a good parking place, so he parked his convertible on the lawn, repeatedly. The gardeners retaliated by letting a sprinkler run into that area, and when he came out to go home, the car had several inches of water in it. Did Widlar retaliate after that? Nobody remembers. But even Widlar knew that sometimes it's time to quit when you're overmatched. Charlie Spork, who's just retired as the president of National Semiconductor, told me about the first time he met Bob. He was in a hospitality suite of the IEEE in New York City back in 1966. He was reading in electronic news that Raytheon had just brought out the RM-709 as a second source to the Fairchild 709. Bob, who was not pleased at being second-sourced, came over and, uttering a generalised profanity, set fire to the newspaper. Charlie was astonished and threw it into the metal waste basket. Unfortunately, the fire did not go out. As they tried to extinguish the fire, the smoke alarms went off and the fire department arrived. So much for first impressions. When I first came out to National in February of 76, I was in a good mood, and I set about my work whistling cheerfully until Widlar came by. Bob reminded me that my whistling was bothering people. In fact, my whistling was annoying him. He came by about 6 times that day to remind me, and each time I assured him I was trying to stop whistling as well I could. But the music was really circling around gloriously inside my head, trying to get out. He was as good-natured as he could be, and I finally broke the habit, after about a week of reminders. There were just certain kinds of annoying sounds that he felt he didn't have to put up with, and to a large extent he was fair about that. Hacksawing large pieces of metal, take it outside. Drilling many holes in a chassis, wait till everybody went out to lunch. Print out a huge printout on the new line printer. Well, if Widlar could not get this noise delayed until lunchtime, Widlar would just go out to lunch with Dobkin or Minio or both, right then, whether it was 10 a.m. or 3 p.m. Widlar did not need much aggravation to convince him it was lunchtime. Some days he did indeed drink a lot of lunch. But that didn't prevent Bob getting from lots of good ideas done. It may have helped. We still have a sign around our lab, "This is not a blacksmith's shop." But there were times when Bob would discover he had wasted a day or two just because one bad part had screwed up his circuit. He would bring this bad part, a capacitor, a pot, a transistor, an IC or whatever to the vice, and lay it on the anvil part. Then he would calmly, methodically beat it with a hammer until the smallest remaining part was indistinguishable from the dust on the floor. Then he would go back to work and get the right answer. He explained that it makes you feel much better if you do this, and know that bad part will never come around again and goof you up. He was right, and I recommend that you join me in doing this Widlarizing when a bad component fools you. You will feel a lot better. One time, Bob was out drinking beer with his friends, and he told his friend Ken Kraft that he could drink a mug of beer faster than Kraft could throw the mug of beer over his shoulder. At the word go, Ken flung his beer over his shoulder in about a second flat. Widlar just stood there and smiled, and slowly raised his mug to his lips, saying, "You win." So what technical things did Bob accomplish? Well, in addition to the op-amps and the band-gap references, Bob also brought out the industry's first high-power voltage regulator, the LM-109. A couple of people reminded me that in the autumn of 67, there had been a big controversy about whether it would be possible for anybody to build a high-power regulator on one monolithic chip. There were little letters to the editor in several magazines, pro and con. Finally, Widlar settled the argument by writing an authoritative-sounding letter. It pointed out that the thermal gradients on a chip would make it impossible to make a high-power chip with good performance. And the features would be impossible. The reliability would be impossible. That settled the argument. Everybody shut up, because obviously Widlar knew what he was talking about. Then, 2 months later, Widlar introduced the 20-watt LM-109, and it included all those features that Widlar had said were impossible. All the IC engineers realised Widlar had been taking them for a ride, and that he had a last laugh. What a master of the art of playing games. When the LM-109s were ready for testing, Widlar designed a tester, and Ken Kraft built it up. Widlar came over to try it out. He griped, It works okay, but the start button is on the wrong side. It ought to be on the right, not the left. The next day, Widlar came by the box and there was a big arrow, push to test, pointing at a blank area on the right side at the top of the box. Widlar, being a curious sort, decided to push where it was indicated. Immediately the test sequence began and cycled through, with a green light going on. What the heck, there was no push button there. But every time Widlar pushed that spot on the panel, the test sequence occurred. Ken had cut away the copper foil at that place and installed a sensitive light detector under the epoxy PVC board material. When you put your finger on that spot and blocked off the light, it would trigger the tester, as a conventional push button would too. Widlar was pleased that his guys would come up with sneaky, ingenious schemes like that. Obviously, there will be never another engineer like Widlar. He led the linear IC industry in many amazing new directions. I think every circuit designer has looked at one of Widlar's creations and said, "Good heavens, you can do that?" If that works the way he says it does, then I could use some of these ideas to improve my circuits. I'm not sure if Bob Widlar ever designed an obvious circuit in his life. That's by Bob Pease in Electronic Design. If you don't open your eyes, then you're gonna get hurt. And she keeps telling you lies, she's just a full-time nurse. Now I don't count the wrong, but you're the one I ask to care for. And you won't see me no more if you see that girl. Now you may think she's fine when she's out with you, but she only comes around when she's got nothing to do. I don't want to interfere, but that girl seems so insincere, and I won't hang around here if you see that girl. Do you Here's a letter from Ian Bigger in Troon, Ayrshire. He writes, "One of the presenters mentioned that he was once a Radio Caroline DJ. That's me, Andy Burnham. The one feature that really grabbed my attention was from the Derry Journal, all about the radio scene in Northwest Ireland. He listens on a Grundig Yacht Boy 700 portable with telescopic antenna. He continues, "As you will gather, I am very interested in the Irish radio scene, and have been since 1977, when I first heard Radio Dublin on 253 metres. I worked over there for some 2 years on the stations and enjoyed every minute of it. Great crack. As I write, there's been another bit of trouble over there. Radio North is still off air, with its caravan studio base apparently empty. North Atlantic Radio and Riverside 101 are still on. There are several court cases pending, so we will have to wait and see. I hope Radio Facts are able to continue, as your programmes are serving a unique purpose. Best wishes to you. Sparks is an excellent programme, well produced and varied. So in closing, I would like to wish you, and all at Radio Facts, much success in the future. Well, cheers to you back, Ian. And here's Trevor.
Digital Dolby for the cinema. Dolby Laboratories is competing with Eastman Kodak in producing a digital sound system for cinemas. Dolby's SRD is substantially different from its rival. Sound and Communication Systems magazine details the new technology and talks to experts about its potential impact on the movie-going public. Dolby has played a key part in the development of sound systems for the cinema. Its stereo system is generally considered as one of the saviours of the medium, with 1976's Star Wars the first film to use the format, breaking box office records and reawakening interest in the movies. Since the 1950s, television had steadily eroded the appeal of cinema, and while Star Wars went some way in redressing the balance, home video brought audience figures to an all-time low in the middle 1980s. With the video rental business itself now in the doldrums, and the high-profile and high-commercial multiplexes attracting a new generation of cinema-goer, Dolby is looking to repeat its success almost 13 years later. Digital is the thing this time, offering even further enhancement of sound to the cognoscenti and a useful and welcome selling tool to cinema managers who have seen crowds return lured in by the magic logos Dolby Stereo and latterly Dolby SR and in the West End THX. For almost 10 years, digital has been a powerful drawing element in the domestic audio market. Compact disc is perhaps the leading example. Eastman Kodak, in collaboration with the Optical Radiation Company, recognised this and last year announced Cinema Digital Sound, CDS. The system has been demonstrated in the United States and Europe, but has yet to make an impact on the market. One of its major drawbacks is that a total re-equipment program is required to upgrade theatres to digital. Some of the major cinema chains have raised doubts about the financial viability of this. Dolby is promoting its own system, SRD, as being completely compatible with existing analog audio tracks. SR, spectral recording, analog signals, are fitted in the conventional position alongside the frames, and digital data in the gap between the sprocket holes. By doing this, the company claims, all Dolby SRD prints will become single inventory, allowing films to be played in almost any cinema. The main beneficiaries from the system will be the multiplexers, where movies are rotated around the various screens to produce optimum revenue. In its official literature, Dolby says that the development of SRD is in answer to demands from within the industry for digital soundtracks and economical 35mm optical prints, which offer the same multi-channel facilities as 70mm magnetic stock, which is seen as too expensive. The company sees other advantages of the system. For example, all picture and sound information is on the film. There are few alterations in laboratory procedures. High longevity is promised, and the system provides left, centre, right, left and right surround, and subwoofer channels, a feature it shares with CDS. Like CDS, the Dolby technique is a six-channel system, but SRD is claiming more compatibility with existing installations in cinemas. Dolby CP55 and CP200 processors can be upgraded for SRD by adding a digital input, although earlier units will not be supported by the new technology. A reader will be installed in or near the projector and connected to a decoding box, which outputs analog signals, processing them from the digital before routing them out into the cinema. Dolby is claiming that there is little need for additional equipment beyond the setup, making it possible for theatres to continue using its existing technology. However, Dolby is advising cinemas that haven't upgraded loudspeakers and amplifiers for SR releases to invest in these items for SRD. Not doing this would be like putting a big engine in a small car without the upgraded suspension, brakes and tyres necessary to take advantage of the new engine's higher performance. A single sound negative is needed to print both digital and analog data, which means there is no requirement for changes in existing sound negative development practice. Laboratories producing prints will need to add simple mechanisms to place the digital track in the intersprocket area. While the digital track will not need redevelopment, the analog SR will have to go through this process. At the moment, there has been no announcement about the first films to use the format, although Dolby says that offers have been made, including two major European productions. Early next year has been slated as the official launch date. According to John Isles, Dolby's film projects manager, it depends on when the equipment can be supplied to the cinemas. Some sections of current or recent films, including The Silence of the Lambs, Dances with Wolves, The Hunt for Red October, and The Abyss, have been reprocessed with SRD for demonstration purposes. Isles confirmed that previously released films could be retrofitted with the format, although this would probably only occur with high-prestige re-releases. As with most launches of this magnitude, Dolby is being coy about the cost. Isles said that SRD is expected to be affordable and competitive. Asked how competitive it would be with Kodak ORC CDS, he replied, "Extremely." Last year, Kodak stated that CDS was the most important advance in cinema sound for decades. SRD must be seen in the same light, but there is still speculation over how much impact it will make with the cinema going public. The technicians hope that it will be the improved sound quality that will be appreciated, but the cynical observe that its true worth may well be as a lure. That article about digital sound for cinema release prints from Sound and Communication Systems.
I'm a citizen of Little Land, traveling, commuting, traveling.
From Electronics and Wireless World, cross-modulation in the sky. RF engineers are well aware that non-linearity breeds cross-modulation, but Anthony Garrett suggests that it can also occur in the ionosphere. If you have ever been irritated by hearing one radio station superimposed on top of another of a different frequency, you have been listening to cross-modulation. The effect is distinct from, and rarer than, overhearing one station on top of another on the same frequency. Two stations of the same frequency are always picked up simultaneously, but if broadcasting authorities are cooperating properly, one signal will be so strong in its area of intended reception that the ear generally cannot distinguish the other. Sometimes freak propagation effects cause the signal of the second to be channeled through the ionosphere to the receiver, with much less attenuation, and it will be overheard. But this is not cross-modulation, which involves stations of different broadcasting frequencies. To tell the difference, you need a radio ham's list of stations and frequencies. To explain why cross-modulation takes place, we should first look at how the ionized plasma in the ionosphere interacts with electromagnetic waves. Since charge is the source of electric fields, a plasma has a large effect on an electromagnetic wave propagating through it. The ionospheric plasma is not uniform in density, because the sun's rays are more powerful higher up, and there are more atoms available to be ionized lower down. The effect is to bend radio waves so that they eventually return to Earth, and make long-distance radio transmission possible. The clue to ionospheric cross-modulation is that the unwanted or disturbing transmitter always lies between the receiver and the wanted transmitter. This strongly suggests that it is an interaction between the signals which takes place within the part of the ionosphere where both waves coexist. Normally, a single wave propagating through an ionospheric plasma disturbs it to an amount proportional to the size of the wave. Two or more waves propagate independently, each disturbing the plasma as if the others were not there. Total disturbance of the plasma is found by adding the disturbances caused by each wave separately. The waves deposit no net energy in the plasma, and the energy of the waves just passes through. But if a wave is powerful enough, it does now transfer energy to the electrons, which in turn pass it on to neutral atoms and molecules with which they collide. This energy transfer modifies the plasma over and above the usual disturbances, non-linearly, and any other wave propagating through it feels this. If the powerful disturbing wave is modulated, this modulation is imprinted on the rate at which energy is transferred to the electrons, and so on the fundamental properties of the plasma, and then on to any other wave passing through. This is the basis of the effect. Energy takes about 1/1000th of a second to work its way from the wave to the molecules by collisions with electrons. In 1959, David Laser and Donald Menzel in the United States worked out a kinetic theory of cross-modulation in the ionosphere, though their theory did not include the important effect of the Earth's magnetic field. If a permanent magnetic field is present, electrons orbit round its direction at a definite frequency, and a wave whose fundamental frequency is close to this will kick the electrons in phase at each revolution and transfer much more energy than otherwise. Resonance. Inclusion of the Earth's magnetic field is lengthy, but is ultimately only a matter of detail. It is, of course, essential in order to compare with the experiment. Since the effect takes place in the ionosphere, there is no way of designing a transmitter or receiver to eliminate it. The only good advice is not to broadcast really powerful signals on or near the resonance or gyro frequency. The news is not all bad, though. The effect has been used as a tool for learning more about electron collisions in the ionosphere, and this tells us more about how radio wave attenuation works, and how powerful a transmitter would be needed to reach given parts of the world. That was by Anthony Garrett in Electronics and Wireless World.
And
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Incidentally, if you'd like to try and hear some cross-modulation for yourself, the best place we've found to hear it is in the long wave band, with all the very powerful stations down there. I can't quite remember which two stations it is, one cross-modulating on the other. However, I think it's the strong station from Algeria on 254 kHz, and Radio Luxembourg on 236 kHz, something like that. If you tune round one of the strong stations on long wave, you can quite often hear some good cross-modulation. So, on to a letter from Richard R. McVicker, writing from Quito in Ecuador, South America. He listens on 12255 kHz and writes, "Warm greetings from high in the Andes Mountains. I was wondering if you've had any other reports from Ecuador or even South America." Well, we have. Also, in South America, we've had reports from Brazil and Peru. He continues, "From time to time, it's possible to listen to some of the lower-powered European stations right here in Quito. If you look at a map, you'll find that there is actually very little land between Ecuador and Northern Europe, even though Ecuador is on the west coast of South America. We do have trouble picking you up on 6205 kHz, though, even when your station hours are not quite on at the same time. That's all from Quito. Please take best of care." He's a DX Party Line member over there. And thanks for your report. So, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. And if you'd like a reply, don't forget to enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG.
Digital audio broadcasting is at a fairly advanced level of development, although there is still some way to go before we can expect a UK-wide multi-channel service. Henry Price, in a BBC press release, describes the progress so far. The compact disc is one of the most successful consumer products of the last decade. First marketed in the UK in 1983, the sales of CD players were running at just under 2 million per year by 1990, and over 25% of households had at least one player. The use of CD and other consumer digital sound systems has thrown into sharp relief the shortcomings of the present VHF-FM radio broadcast system. Being analog, the FM system's overall performance is the sum of the performances of the individual parts of the chain. The quality heard at home or in the car is often limited by either the receiver and antenna performance, or reception problems such as interference, multipath distortion, or inadequate signal level. Many dedicated radio listeners go to considerable trouble and expense to overcome such problems, and with care, the FM system can then deliver a performance approaching that of the CD. However, many other listeners end up with an inferior service, not comparable with CD quality. For some years, engineers have been looking at ways in which a digital radio service could be broadcast to the general public. Such a service would ideally have the following features: sound quality comparable with the CD, capable of offering coverage to all listeners, capable of fixed, mobile and portable reception with a simple low-gain antenna, simple push-button program selection with no tuning, frequency efficient so that many services could be provided in any spectrum available, and capable of operation from satellite and or terrestrial transmitters. Since the 1970s, research engineers in various countries have been looking at ways in which these requirements could be met. In the mid-1970s, BBC research engineers investigated the possibility of providing a digital radio service based on a NICAM stereo signal. A series of tests was conducted in the northeast of England using the Pontop Pike transmitting station near Consett, County Durham. The NICAM digital stereo signal was radiated from this site using four-phase DPSK modulation of a 47 MHz carrier. A vehicle was equipped to receive and decode the signals. Two antenna systems were used. Firstly, a directional antenna mounted on a 10-metre extendable mast, and secondly, an omnidirectional antenna mounted on the vehicle's roof. It was found that reception on the directional antenna at 10 metres was generally satisfactory within the predicted service area of the transmitter. However, reception was not possible over a significant proportion of the service area when using the vehicle's rooftop antenna. This failure was generally caused by multipath reception, which resulted in considerable inter-symbol interference to the digital signal. It was concluded from the tests that simple digital systems, such as NICAM, could provide an excellent service to fix directional antennas at rooftop height, as anyone able to receive NICAM stereo television will testify. However, reception on omnidirectional antennas close to the ground was unlikely to be satisfactory, especially in highly built-up and mountainous areas. Thus, in order to cope with mobile and portable reception, a more advanced digital system would be required. Over the last few years, such an advanced system has been developed and tested within Europe. Two project groups from the EBU and Eureka Project 147 have been jointly working on a system known as Digital Audio Broadcasting, DAB. This system is specially designed for mobile and portable reception and can be transmitted terrestrially or from satellite or even a mixture of both. If a DAB system is to be capable of mobile and portable reception, it should be able to operate in poor signal-to-noise conditions and with significant amounts of multipath interference. Although many digital coding and modulation systems cope well with poor signal-to-noise ratios, the problem of failure due to multipath reception has been more difficult to resolve. In a simple digital system, such as the television stereo sound system, NICAM, inter-symbol interference starts to become significant once the delay between the main and reflected signals becomes greater than about a quarter of a symbol period. As the delay is increased to a whole symbol period, the interference becomes very severe, and if the amplitude of the delayed signal is sufficient, it will be impossible to decode the signal. NICAM 728 has a bit rate of 728 kilobits per second and a symbol period of 2.7 microseconds. Thus, reflected signals with delays of greater than about 0.7 microsecond will cause problems. This delay is equivalent to a reflection from a building approximately 100 meters behind the antenna. If a DAB system is to operate successfully in heavily built-up and mountainous areas, it must be able to cope with reflected signals of a greater delay than 0.7 microseconds. In fact, it should be able to operate with delays up to about 50 times as great, i.e. reflections from objects 5 kilometers behind the antenna. This implies that the symbol period should be of the order of 140 microseconds, i.e. about 7.3 kilosymbols per second. This is obviously far too low for high-quality sound, but if many such low data rate channels were available, then the total data rate could be sufficient. For instance, if a sound system were to need 730 kilobits per second, then the data capacity of 100 such low data rate channels would be required. The sound data would then be spread equally over the 100 channels. The European DAB system operates on this principle, using a modulation system known as Coded Orthogonal Frequency Division Multiplex, COFDM. In the COFDM system, a large number of low data rate carriers are packed as close together in frequency as is theoretically possible. The carriers are frequency division multiplexed in an interleaved fashion. The frequency spacing between the carriers is chosen to satisfy a special relationship with the rate of data transmission, such that the information on the carriers can be demodulated without mutual interference. Thus, the individual carriers can be considered as being orthogonal to one another. As the bit rate of each of the data carriers is very low, they will be relatively insensitive to multipath interference. However, to further increase the system's immunity to delayed signals, a guard interval is also added between each symbol. Generally, the length of the guard interval will be about a quarter of the active symbol period. Provided the reflected signal has a delay of less than the guard interval, it will combine constructively with the main signal and will contribute to the overall signal power. The effect of inter-symbol interference does not become damaging until the reflected signal's delay reaches a value equal to about twice the guard interval. The COFDM system is capable of carrying a large number of sound channels, with the data for each sound channel being spread across a number of the low data rate carriers. Complex error correction codes and advanced decoding techniques are employed in the system, which enables the sound signals to be recovered even if large amounts of data are missing or corrupted. In coping with multipath reception, this is particularly important, as reflections can cause deep notches in the signal, which would remove one or more of the individual low data rate carriers. The COFDM signal is treated at the transmitter and demodulated at the receiver using the fast Fourier transform algorithm. This is the key to making the COFDM a practical system, since a vast bank of filters and modulators would otherwise be required. Considerable progress has been made in the last few years in developing low bit rate coding systems for high quality sound. It is now possible to code a 15 kHz audio signal using a bit rate of about 100 kilobits per second, in other words, a little over a quarter of that used by the NICAM system. The bit rate reduction technique used is based on a recognized property of human hearing. It has been shown that if a loud sound is present at one frequency, then it will mask quieter sounds at similar frequencies. The audio spectrum is divided into a number of sub-bands, each of which is separately quantized using individual scale factors covering short time blocks, like the NICAM process. In order to keep the bit rate low, the quantizing process is relatively coarse, and as a consequence, the level of quantizing noise generated is correspondingly high. However, as the noise is restricted to the same frequency subband as the signal, it will be inaudible because it is masked by the actual audio signal.
What do you do when the people go home? And what do you do when the show is all done? I know what I'll do in the alone of my time. I do with the leftover wine. A line from a poem of my childhood has said that visions of sugar plums were gonna dance in my head. I'll spend my whole life making the time right, but I'll still have a bowl of a song of mine. You know I'm gonna do anything just to take up time, 'cause I can't find a taker for the leftover wine.
the show is all done.
Details of the digital audio broadcasting system from the BBC. Because the DAB system has been designed to be relatively immune to multipath effects, the receiver should operate successfully when two or more signals are received, provided the total delay between the signals does not greatly exceed the guard interval. So far, we have considered the situation where the delayed signal is caused by a reflection from an object. However, the source of such a delayed signal could equally be another transmitter, which simply amplifies and re-radiates the signal on the same frequency, a device known as an active deflector. The delay would then be equal to the difference in path length between the direct signal and that via the active deflector. On this basis, active deflectors could be used to supplement coverage of a satellite service. The satellite would give bulk coverage to rural and urban areas, while active deflectors would boost the signal strength for heavily screened areas, such as city centres. A mobile receiver in such an area would receive two signals, one from the satellite and the other from the active deflector. Provided the relative delay between the two signals was not significantly greater than the guard interval, then the system would operate well. This mix of satellite and terrestrial transmission is known as a hybrid system. During 1990, Research Department conducted a series of DAB tests in South London. The system used employs an early version of MASCAM, which is the masking pattern subband coding and multiplexing, and can transmit up to 32 sound channels, i.e. 16 stereo programs. Each MASCAM sound channel requires a data rate of about 136 kilobits per second, with another 32 kilobits per second of error correction data being added to give an overall bit rate of some 168. For the 32 sound channels, a bit rate of 5.5 megabits per second is required. This data is carried on 448 carriers, each spaced 15.625 kilohertz apart. The spectrum occupied by the signal is therefore about 7 megahertz. Each individual carrier conveys useful data at a rate of 12.5 kilobits per second, with an overall symbol period of 80 microseconds. Each 80 microsecond symbol consists of a guard interval of 16 microseconds and an active data period of 64 microseconds. The system will therefore be completely immune to reflected signals with delays up to 16 microseconds, and should not be substantially degraded until the delay reaches about 32 microseconds. Minimum distances of 2.4 and 4.8 kilometers respectively from reflecting objects behind the antenna. A main digital audio broadcast transmitter was located at the Crystal Palace mast, radiating a maximum of 140 watts ERP in a southerly direction on 531 megahertz television channel 28. At the Kenley Television Relay Station, 12 kilometres south of Crystal Palace, an active deflector was located, which received the incoming signal and, after amplification, re-radiated it at a power of 3 watts. The active deflector was designed to cover an area of the Kenley Valley, which is heavily screened from Crystal Palace. A Renault Espace was equipped with a DAB receiver connected to a quarter-wave whip antenna mounted on a ground plane above the car's roof. The vehicle was used to measure the coverage of the two transmitters. At the edge of the coverage area, the system experienced near brick wall failure. Amusingly, in the brief period between the error rate becoming high and the receiver muting, the sound took on a curious Donald Duck quality. The active deflector at Kenley successfully provided coverage to the heavily screened valley, and the receiver was able to cross between the service areas of two transmitters with no audible effect to the service. The system used for the South London tests transmits 16 stereo channels in a bandwidth of 7 MHz. Further development of the MASCAM coding technique suggests that a 12-channel stereo sound service could be operated in a 4 MHz bandwidth. The outstanding question now is where in the spectrum could sufficient space be found for such a service. The DAB system tested in South London has been designed mainly with satellite and hybrid transmission in mind. The satellite service could operate from a geostationary orbit to both mobile and portable receivers equipped with simple low-gain antennas. Alternatively, a number of satellites in a highly inclined elliptical orbit could be used, with higher gain antennas being employed on the receivers. No frequency band is yet allocated for such services, but it appears as if the UHF range might be the most appropriate. However, there are many demands on this spectrum, and it is difficult to identify where an allocation might be found. The World Administrative Radio Conference, to be held in 1992, will attempt to identify a suitable spectrum allocation for a DAB satellite service. The BBC is playing an important role in the UK's preparatory work for this conference. The DAB system may also operate terrestrially, but the tests in South London have indicated that UHF may not be the most suitable frequency range for such a service. Diffraction losses at UHF are high, and this causes deep shadow zones behind obstacles such as hills and buildings. It therefore appears that the VHF range may be more suitable spectrum for terrestrial DAB. Once again, no international spectrum has been allocated specifically for such a service, and it is hard to identify where such an allocation might be found. The ability of the DAB system to cope with two or more signals with large relative delays between them may be further exploited in the development of a terrestrial single frequency network. In such a system, all the main transmitters would operate at precisely the same frequency, probably in the VHF range. The signal from each transmitter would be timed so that in the crossover areas between transmitters, the relative signal delays would be minimized. However, despite this, path length differences from two or more transmitters to the receiver could now be many tens of kilometers. Therefore, the symbol rate of the individual data signals will need to be further reduced. An active symbol period of 1024 microseconds is now being considered for use in single frequency networks, which, with a guard interval of 256 microseconds, gives an overall symbol period of 1280. Such a digital audio broadcast system would laugh off path length differences of some 77 kilometres and would probably cope with delays of twice this amount. It has been proposed that the transmitters of the single frequency network could be fed from a common satellite DAB signal received at some other frequency, probably 10 or 12 gigahertz. The correct timing of the transmitted signals could then be achieved by suitably adjusting digital signal delays at each site. The system will also need to be locked to a common VHF transmission frequency. Such a signal distribution scheme has one particular advantage for the listener and assists the broadcaster in establishing a service. Provided the satellite signal were reasonably strong, it would be receivable throughout the whole coverage area on relatively small, simple dish receiving systems from the start of the service. Thus, people in rural areas who wanted the service on fixed receivers could opt to receive it immediately, although they might have to wait some time for the full benefits of the terrestrial service. If the UK is considered in isolation, it would require some 4 MHz of spectrum to provide an SFN for 12 stereo channels. As mentioned earlier, it seems unlikely that an international allocation will be found for this purpose in the near future. The BBC is therefore investigating the possibility of a UK allocation being found, which is acceptable to other users of the spectrum both in the UK and neighbouring countries, especially ERA, France, Belgium and Holland. BBC Research Department is studying whether any spectrum in the existing international VHF bands 1 and 3 can be used. Tests will be conducted during the remainder of 1991 to evaluate the pros and cons of using these parts of the VHF spectrum. It is worth comparing the spectrum requirements of the DAB single frequency network with the UK's FM national networks. Each FM network needs 2.2 MHz of spectrum to provide coverage to some 98% of the population. In contrast, a DAB service would provide a national 12 stereo channel service in 4 MHz, a six-fold improvement over FM. However, this is a somewhat unfair comparison, as the 4 MHz of DAB spectrum is needed for the UK alone, while the spectrum used for FM has to be shared across most of Europe. Even so, DAB makes very efficient use of the radio spectrum, a factor which is likely to become even more important in the future. Computer-based technology will be used in the receiver to implement the advanced digital systems needed for DAB. After suitable RF filtering, the DAB signal will be digitized, and all the subsequent processing will be done in the digital domain. The carriers will be demodulated using fast Fourier transform processing. The desired audio signal will be selected by altering the demodulation process rather than by modifying or changing components. As far as the listener is concerned, there will be no tuning and the receiver will be totally push-button. Virtually the whole receiver will be implemented using VLSI circuits. If worldwide frequency allocations are made available for satellite DAB and agreement can be reached on a single world standard, then, with large-scale production, the cost of receivers should be extremely low. It is very important that this technology be inexpensive and readily available if it is to be attractive to developing countries, since in many of these countries it will be cheaper to install such a DAB service than a terrestrial VHF FM network. Such a development could also enable multinational services to be offered by satellite to areas of common interest, such as Europe. So, the development of the DAB system has opened up a number of exciting possibilities for radio broadcasting. Hopefully, it will not be too long before listeners in the UK are able to benefit from this development. That piece by Henry Price from BBC Engineering.
A report from Electronic World News. Researchers build tiny transformers by Simon Lowe. A group of researchers at Kingston Polytechnic, which is just down the road from the Spark Studio, has developed a technique for building transformers with a profile of 5 millimetres. The development could lead to smaller power supplies with an almost flat profile, the researchers said. By using a thick-film alumina substrate with a platinum-silver material used for conductive tracks, the group has developed a transformer capable of operating at up to 2 MHz, with an efficiency of up to around 85%. Peter Barnwell, the project leader, said the research could lead to power supplies that are cheaper than conventional wound transformers. Although the work is not yet complete, Barnwell expects transformer efficiency to be improved to above 90% for power outputs of up to 100 watts. The current design incorporates a ferrite pole and 2 ferrite discs sandwiching the transformer. Although the centre pole increases the cost of the transformer, it also boosts its efficiency. However, the team at Kingston believes transformers without the ferrite pole and offering efficiencies of greater than 90% are possible. Working with the group in Kingston is ERA Technology, based in Leatherhead. ERA is building a range of power supplies based on the hybrid transformer. Designed for lighting and electronics applications, the supply electronics is built on a substrate similar in size to the transformer, around 2 by 2 inches. Supplies with AC and DC outlets have been built, according to Don Pedar, the leader of the ERA researchers, and he expects further reductions in the size of power supplies for DC-DC conversion applications. Pedar hopes to build supplies with operating frequencies up to 10 MHz, which would result in a 75% reduction in the substrate area required. The two teams of researchers are being funded by the UK government and 4 companies interested in the technology. Pedder said the companies should be launching the first products based on the idea next year. It's Sparks from Radiofax. And here's a letter from Andrew Keddy, North Highcombe in Lincoln. He writes, I happened to find your signals the last week as I was tuning around the bands and heard the programme Sparks, which I found very interesting. I'm sure I've heard your station before, maybe as far back as last summer. Well, I think you may have done, Andrew. He listens on a JRC NRD 525 with a 40-metre long wire, an ATU and an audio filter.